Okay, thanks. I'm happy to be here. It was a nice trip, a much shorter trip today than I had expected. So mine's a little different. As everyone else is kind of focusing on one country, I'm focusing on one world and talking about the use of multinational protocols and including really as many countries as possible in the research projects that you're doing. Kind of why do we do these very large multi-country studies? I really go to the last point I have on the slide because it's really fun. There is so much to learn and so much to gain from working with as many different cultures and colleagues as possible, and that's what these studies provide you with. But besides that, one of the goals that we've had at the Institute for Global Tobacco Control is to really support our colleagues in lower resource areas so that they can generate their own locally relevant data for their policymakers. So it's not just what's happened in Europe or in America, but what's happening on all their streets. To generate internationally comparative data, we found that nothing's can entice and encourage policymakers better than a little competition. And so competition with your neighboring country is always a good impetus for policy change. It also helps to identify the cultural, social, and economic differences between our countries and really kind of pinpoint the at-risk populations and places that we need to focus our attention more. And finally, it's to build research capacity. And, you know, even one study can really involve a lot of training and a lot of experience so that our colleagues in these countries can continue to do the work on their own after the project is over. There's a lot of challenges with working with multinational studies, and I'm glad that was the theme of this topic, because I'll come back then to a lot of these challenges. The biggest challenge I think that we face in doing these very large international studies is time. And it really spans from a simple email. When we're so used to sending out our email and getting an immediate response, you always have to remember they're all asleep. And so you're not getting a response to your email until the next day. So while something that when you're dealing with your colleagues at the local level or even at the national level, maybe you have a 3-hour delay, but when you're working with your colleagues in China and India and Vietnam and Brazil, you often will take a week to get one simple email exchange completed. And so you have to be a lot more patient when you're working on these large international studies. Access is always a problem. We've been working now for about 7 years on these international studies, and our research network spans about 45 countries probably now. I think that we have research colleagues available to us in 45 countries, but it's taken a lot of time to build those relationships and get access to colleagues and researchers in that number of countries. And hopefully, as more and more people are conducting research in these relationships build, the access issue will become less important and time will be reduced. Communication is always an issue, not only in terms of time, but languages and expectations. Along with that comes the quality of the research that you're conducting. Obviously, here at Johns Hopkins, we have very high expectations of the type of research quality that's being generated. And as you get further and further away from the center, the less control you have over the type of work that's being conducted in the field. And always a favorite subject of every panel that I've been on talking about international research protocols is the issue of human subjects. So in case you're wondering, human subjects is always a challenge, but I would say 5 years ago when I would present on our international studies, it would be very commonly expected that it was an hurdle that could not be overcome in many cases. And our experience is that that's just absolutely not the case. We just completed a study in 32 countries dealing with women and children, and we were able to get human subjects approval from every single country. And so that should be an expectation, and although it's sometimes time-consuming, there's no reason to think going in that you can't get it. Global tobacco control, I think, is an issue in global health now that may be just a few steps ahead in terms of international research collaborations and some other subjects. And so I'm just going to give you a review of some of the major international research protocols that we have been doing at Hopkins. And that includes secondhand smoke monitoring in Latin America, secondhand smoke monitoring in homes and women and children, like I said, in 32 countries, secondhand smoke monitoring in bars that's been done now in nearly 30 countries, the Southeast Asian Tobacco Control Alliance tracking tool studies that was done in a number of Southeast Asian countries. But then there's a whole range of other tobacco control networks that are taking place that aren't at Hopkins, so I won't be speaking about them because I'm not as well versed in them. But I-10, the ITC, the GTRN, if you go on, there's a plethora of these very large multinational research protocols that are going on in tobacco. So primarily the work at Hopkins has been focused on secondhand smoke. So why are we studying that? We have a lot of reasons, but first there's obvious interesting research questions that can be answered regarding nicotine in the air and secondhand smoke concentrations and intake among different environments, temperatures, housing, ethnicities, to characterize the different exposures that are taking place in those different environments and among those people, women, children, teens, adults, to do baseline surveillance and then to be able to go back and evaluate progress in public health programs aimed at tobacco control, to evaluate the effectiveness of specific interventions, and also to monitor FCTC implementation. The Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, obviously a cornerstone now in all the global tobacco control efforts, which I think also provides the baseline for the big need to be thinking internationally when doing research and not just necessarily focused on only one country. We need comparisons internationally to support the FCTC. And it specifically calls for the effective protection in all indoor public places from secondhand smoke. There's a number of things that we've been doing in our international research projects, including questionnaires, surveys and observations, indoor air monitoring of nicotine, and also doing biomarker studies internationally. So the first research project that we did was secondhand smoke in public places in Latin America. The main funders was the Pan American Health Organization and the Johns Hopkins, and then the in-country partners are listed below. And I just want to point out what's really important about this is the real range of partners that we have engaged. So there are a few universities, and you can see INCA from Brazil is listed. But then there's a lot of NGOs and much smaller but much more active partners. And so that's really important to think about when you're working internationally is who's going to be effective in disseminating the results and who's going to be able to make a difference. So while it might be most natural for an academic to reach out to an academic, it's not necessarily the most effective thing to do. So we've been really trying to find out the partner in the country who will really make policy change occur, since this type of research is obviously very policy relevant. The secondhand smoke study was measuring airborne nicotine concentrations in public places, including schools, hospitals, city buildings, airports, restaurants, bars, all types of public places, really kind of modeled after similar studies that have been done already in the United States and throughout Europe. The results found that there was nicotine present in nearly all facilities that were tested, including schools, and restaurants had extremely high levels. The other thing that was found is that the levels of nicotine were directly correlated to the policies that were in place in those countries. So when you look at Uruguay and Argentina, for example, they consistently have the highest levels of nicotine present in public places, and they have also the lowest and weakest tobacco control laws in place and the highest prevalence. So the results were very consistent with the policies. The results were published in JAMA, and just again, in terms of building capacity, all the coordinators from the national level were included on the paper. It got a lot of media impact within the countries, and through the newspapers, online, and even academically, the Tobacco Atlas used the study to generate cross-country comparisons. And perhaps the most important outcome of this first AIR study was that the president of Uruguay actually highlighted the specific study in his directive making all health facilities smoke-free after finding that they had the highest levels of nicotine in health facilities. So really, the idea that it was kind of almost a shame that they were the worst really pushed them to enact something right away. So based on the success of that study, we decided that it was actually quite easy to do and not very time consuming, and we could really step it up a little bit and do more countries, go global, and also include biological samples in our study. So the next project we did was the Family Home Study. It was actually 32 countries because we did do it in the United States, although our field team was not very successful and we never were able to get the results. So that shows you how sometimes the proximity isn't always a virtue. But we did it in a large number of countries with very diverse environments and cultures. Our goal was to characterize the levels of secondhand smoke in homes, and also among the exposure among the women and children living in those homes through hair samples. The goal was to identify the baseline for future monitoring and also to build capacity in as many countries as possible. We took some convenient samples from each study. That was one of the study's main limitations, but getting representative samples from that many countries is very difficult and also resource intensive. And so our goal in the end was to get as many countries participating in the study rather than spend a lot of resources on any one specific one. But what's also interesting about this slide is that you can see the broad range of homes that participated. So on top you have homes in Poland that are cement, double windows, snow outside. You can imagine how much air is filtrating, outside air is filtrating through those homes, versus the home on the bottom is Panama. And not in this picture, but in all the other pictures, you see the people sitting out on the grass smoking. So they're not actually even smoking inside their homes. So that was very typical of the type of environmental differences that took place in this study. That's a picture of the air monitors that we use. And as you can see, they're just hung in any place that we can in the main living quarters of the home. And here's a picture of the children and women getting their hairs cut. As you can see from the picture, you can hardly see it. It's a very little amount of hair. And it's interesting, you talk about challenges. So cutting hair might be seen as a challenge, although it ended up not being a huge one. But cultural differences regards to hair are very important. So in Asian countries, for example, the head is holy, so we had to be very sensitive about touching the hair. The key always to that is making sure that you have local field workers from those communities who know those communities being the people who go into the homes and take the hair. India was another area where women typically don't cut their hair except on their wedding days, in the area that we were actually doing the study. But it was overcome in every instance. Training is very important, and we did two training workshops. We did one in Southeast Asia, and we did another one in Poland. Just to point out, one of the most important things about these training workshops is the camaraderie and the network building that occurs at them. So at the bottom, you can see that was me finishing off my karaoke song, which is someone I think is still going there. At the bottom, you see her holding her imaginary mic. But it's one of those things. And so once you form these relationships, it's very easy to call on people later on to continue doing more research, which is exactly what we've done, starting with public places, and then women and children, and then bars, and then tracking tools. And we've really continued to work with what are now our close friends. Here we went into real homes and practiced. As Erica mentioned, a real key in being able to keep track and keep on top of these very large multi-country studies is standardized data entry and having common forms and then databases that reflect very exactly the forms that were filled out. And we'd also suggest that you get photocopies of every form sent to you, because it actually does take a lot of cleaning and a lot of review to be sure that it's right. I guess the biggest issue is there when you find the one mistake. Again, working so internationally and between languages, it can take months to figure out what that mistake is versus having a copy there and being able to just go in and look at it really quickly. So the results of the home smoking study were actually very interesting. As you can see along the bottom, in Asia, 91% of smokers were smoking in their homes, 82% were smoking around their children. So I think the latest CDC data is that over 80% of smokers now, of homes in the U.S. now have smoking bans, voluntary smoking bans in place. So this is a real difference, and this is a real challenge that we see from this type of study, that throughout the world, the majority of smokers are continuing to smoke in their homes and smoke near their children, really highlighting the fact that we need to do more to educate parents. Here is the hair nicotine data that was released, and the most important thing to see here up above is the non-smoking homes, and you see a dramatic shift to your left, I believe, which is the smoking homes. And so seeing that where smokers and smoking is taking place, you have elevated levels of nicotine in the air. And it's also really good. I work a lot in, for example, in Armenia, we're doing a number of projects, and it's very effective to show our Armenian colleagues that in the world, they have among the very highest levels of secondhand smoke. Here's the hair. It's reflective of the same pattern, where there's smoking taking place. There's more nicotine in the hair of the women and the children living in those homes, and the results are more pronounced among children. Another really interesting thing we found, and we're not entirely sure why, there's some biological, I'm sure, factors involved, but while Asia, because of what you can see in Latin America, because of the kind of housing differences, we did get lower levels of air nicotine in the data, as you kind of would expect, because there's more airflow through the homes and they're not necessarily smoking in their houses. But we didn't see that reflected in the hair nicotine. So while India had very much kind of median to low levels of air nicotine, they had very high levels of hair nicotine. So it's an important issue to follow up on, and it's also important in terms of lobbying and advocacy in those countries, that just because they're warmer and you have more diffusion of the smoke in the air, it doesn't mean that their populations aren't equally or even more exposed. It was very clear, as you can see, in terms of the rising rates of exposure according to the amount of exposure. So none versus two or more smokers in the household results in much higher exposure levels, and also regarding cigarettes per day and if a policy was in place. So I'm gonna skip really quick and just show that again, that global bar study is now taking place in a very large number of countries. And this was, again, kind of a follow-up. So we said, okay, well, this is really interesting. Women and children are important, but what is a really global issue right now? And what really gets policymakers to change? Oh, it's the hospitality industry. They're the most at risk. They're the most exposed. So let's go there. We came to our same partners, our same colleagues. They're now in the field doing a very common protocol, much quicker this time. We've been able to, within about a 1 year, get a very large number of countries on board doing this study, and the results will be out very quickly. Again, the objectives are pretty clear, I think, to this population, to this audience, of why we need to be measuring bar and nightclubs and the employees in those facilities. What we've added this time, always building more capacity, always adding a step, we've added the side pack to the study this time, so they're not just doing hair, they're not just doing the passive monitoring, but they're also doing active monitoring of PM2.5 when they go into these facilities. And the here are some pictures, and one of the most interesting issues with this study is the lack of diversity between the facilities. So in the first picture, you have a bar in Baltimore. The second picture, which looks almost, you can see the brick is almost exactly the same, is a bar, I believe, in Latin America. And then the third one is a bar in Nigeria. So really, the facilities are quite similar despite the different countries and hair and questionnaires taking place. I just wanted to show kind of the different type of data that's generated by the side pack. Here, this is from the Baltimore study, and where you can see the baseline outside measurements taken, the inside measurements taken, where the primary source of that PM2.5 in those facilities is all tobacco smoke, and then the red line being the EPA's 24-hour standard. And you can see in each case the exposure far outweighs the 24-hour standard set by EPA. And this is always very dramatic data for policymakers, and it is in the United States as well as abroad. So this is the type of immediate data that we want to arm our colleagues with. So while they're waiting for the hair and the air nicotine data to come back, they have something immediately to go to with the press. And this was our key messages from Baltimore, but these are the same key messages now that are being shared internationally, again, with very locally relevant data. So they don't have to cite the Baltimore study, but they can cite the Accra study or the Delhi study and say, this is what's happening within the bars in our community. And go. And of course, I had to include that, of course, our study generated smoking ban approval. But it's the type of thing where we did this study 4 days beforehand, and it generated a lot of press, and then the vote took place. And we want to be able to replicate that in as many countries as possible. And finally, just to note that we also have been doing the tracking tools, which Erica also already spoke about, but we did it in Southeast Asia. So there's just a large number of studies going on, and a large number of researchers in these countries that are participating. And we've been involved at Hopkins in a lot of other activities trying to build research networks, and they're very, very difficult to generate. And I think the one thing that works is funding and a project. So if you want to build a network, there's no better way to do it than providing a protocol for everyone to get behind and work together on, and then you have a network for life.
Mm-hmm. We're a little running behind, but I want you to talk to one thing. Mm-hmm. You're talking about building capacity for these countries. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that differentiates the work that's going on at the Institute for Global Tobacco Control is that when you leave these countries, you leave behind people who can take on the work.
Yeah, I think that's really important, and I think one of the things that I'm hinting at with showing you a large number of studies and not just kind of focusing on one is I want to drive home the message that it's not a one-off occurrence, that these aren't just, you drop in some money and you help them once, you bring them to a training and you leave them back into the field, that this is a relationship that you're really building with these people, and this is, it's a commitment. And their capacity is a commitment. And so we continue to build the capacity. The people who we worked with originally are now regional leaders going out and doing these same studies. And we continually go back and help them out.